Welcome to another Glenbrook podcast, and everything's a bit different from the previous podcasts. I'm not sat in a Tesla like I was last time. I'm in my bedroom at home, which is all a bit weird. But we're all locked down, and we thought we'd try a new type of podcast, and that's one where we're not next to the person we're talking to. We're on Zoom this time, which is a new experience, and on Zoom with me today is David Porter, who is the head of the office for Knight Frank in Manchester. Hello, David.
Hello, Guy.
Where are you, David?
I'm sat in my kids' playroom, leaning against an old, what was, we thought, redundant kitchen table from our old house, which we've kept for 5 years in the garage, which I rescued the other day. And I've set up shop here. And we live just outside a village called Ribchester, which, for those who don't know, is in between Blackburn and Preston. So the deep depth of the Ribble Valley in the northwest.
I think we're both doing pretty well here with our broadband or telephone speeds, because my broadband's on a line of sight, which comes from somewhere over by the M6, and I live in sort of South Cheshire, Shropshire borders. And yours, are you on broadband or are you on mobile phone signal?
No, we're on full broadband. We're very lucky where we are, even though we're in a bit of a dip overlooking a river. The broadband and the connection's great.
Fantastic. Well, we're doing well to actually make this work. It took me a while this week to work out how to do it, but Zoom has come to our saviour yet again. We've known each other, so, first of all, before I pile into how we know each other, you run the office there in Manchester for Knight Frank.
I do, and I've had the pleasure of doing this now since 2007. So we've seen some great times, we've seen some interesting times, and this is something we've never seen before. So I look after a team of just over 40 people and conducting all disciplines of property, commercial and residential, predominantly commercial, both consultancy and transactional.
And we first met, I was thinking about this when I was thinking of who I was going to have a chat with. We met first on Liverpool One when we had about 100,000 square foot of offices in amongst the 180 shops and all the rest of the other things we were building. 100,000 square foot of offices, was that right, about that much?
It was, yes, split across a number of different buildings and lots of different types of buildings, but it was around about that size, yeah.
And we brought you in to let them and get them occupied and income producing, was that right?
That's correct, yeah. So we were brought in probably towards the latter stages of the whole scheme being delivered. With the office elements, so a lot of the office elements were either above some of the retail leisure units or slightly standalone. So we were brought in towards the rear end of the project, but it's something that was really successful, great scheme to be involved with, and much fun at the same time, if I recall.
It feels a little bit, today feels a little bit like it was at the end of Liverpool One, to be honest, in the sense of we'd just gone into the recession and it was all a bit weird and we were trying to find our way, and it seems a little bit like that today. So it's comparable times. And you're an office expert. That's your specialism, isn't it?
Expert's a brave shout. Yes, it is. Day to day, I deal with office leasing, acquisition for tenants, development, and everything that kind of revolves around that.
And therefore, today's theme really, and we're going to talk about it later, is about serviced offices in particular. And I think the reason we thought it'd be interesting to have that conversation is that the market has grown and grown, and we're going to talk about how that's grown over time in Manchester and the Northwest and the UK more generally. And then we're going to look about where it is today and what the future was going to hold and what the future is likely to hold. So that's where we're heading in this discussion. But I wanted to have a chat about you and your career, first of all, and then also hear a bit more about Knight Frank. So how on earth did you end up running the Knight Frank office in Manchester?
Well, it's an interesting one, and it's probably a common theme to a lot of people of my age and my era, where kind of early 90s, went to university, then did a three-year property degree. So I'm not one of those guys that went traveling for a few years and come back, did an MSc or similar in real estate, going to this profession. I did a full three-year property degree. And then, like a lot of people, was thrown out in a period of time where there wasn't much going on in the world, certainly no property jobs going, but I was very fortunate to get a role which was titled as an office junior at, as was then, DTZ Debenham Thorpe in their West End office at the back of Oxford Circus. That's what was 1996.
So straight into London then?
Straight into London, probably being there twice before on school trips. Absolutely green behind the ears. First day roll up off the tube, not knowing where I was going, found the place and was very kindly offered the role, which, as I said, was just literally an office junior. So I had a desk and that was it. There's no phone, there's no computers, nothing. It was just literally helping out as a run around. But again, lots of experience in that office environment at the time. And spent 9 months doing that before the then, as was then, graduate in the team left, actually went over to the States, and they offered me what was her role as the graduate in the office. So just trying to impress, work hard, show enthusiasm, and I was given an opportunity. And I suppose you say the rest is sort of history. So spent, that actually was in their M25 office agency team. So I was, yeah. I was mixing with office agents and picking up what they were doing, and it really interested me. And I then went to work for DTZ for many years thereafter, moved to Knight Frank in 2002, doing the same thing. So I was asked to go and work with them, doing again M25, M4 corridor office leasing and agency.
Quite a difference between DTZ and Knight Frank, I would have thought, in early noughties. You know, ones, the very different sort of cultures, aren't they?
I tell you what, guys, it was it's an overused phrase, but it was a proper eye-opener. I mean, in theory and in practice, I was actually being asked to do the exactly same role that I was doing at DTZ, but at Knight Frank. Same patch, same everything, with people I was mixing with across the industry, but just working with them rather than the others. And the role was so different. The approach to it was so different. It took me, I don't mind saying, it took me a little while to get used to it. But chalk and cheese in terms of their attitude and as I said, approach to their clients and how we dealt with the role.
Was it called Knight Frank and Rutley in those days?
No, it's the Knight Frank Rutley name. The Rutley, bless him, was effectively removed in 1996, so the 100th year anniversary of the business, which prompted actually a question in the House of Commons at PMQ, where someone actually stood up and asked the Prime Minister, whatever happened to Mr. Rutley, which is something which our older partners dine out on still. But no, at the time it was Knight Frank, and we've gone...
My favourite little story there is that in the West End, you used to see a black taxi running around with KFR1 on the registration. And then when they changed their name to Knight Frank from Knight Frank and Rutley, they bought KF1. So we used to get Knight Frank 1 on the registration on the black taxi. Is that right?
And it still exists, albeit it's now a green taxi. And it's a super green taxi because it's one of the new electric ones. So
okay.
And Gary, our driver, is still here working for us. So it's a lovely historic perk, which is well used by the firm.
Fantastic. Sorry, I interrupted you as usual.
No. So again, like a lot of people, after 10 years of working in London, I was at that stage, I was married. We just had our first, who is now 14, believe it or not. And so in 2006, we posed the question about doing something a bit different, perhaps getting out of London. And I remember plucking up the courage to go and speak to Alistair Elliott, who was my day-to-day manager at the time, who's now our senior partner, and just asked him the question about the future and how things could be different for me. And he very, very quickly asked me three questions of what do I want to do, where do I want to go, and when do I want to do it? And I answered all three. And within 24 hours, he came back to me and said they'd effectively created a role as an office agent, an extra office agent in the Manchester office, which is obviously coming back home for me, or certainly the Northwest is home for me. And I could start literally the beginning of the following financial year, which was only kind of 6 to 9 months away. So it was brilliant for me. They really looked after me, and it sort of spurred my career to where I am now.
Absolutely. Well, that's really interesting. And in terms of the Manchester office, so you and I knew each other a little bit because when I was at Grosvenor, I did a piece of work with all the agents in the last recession, and came across you in Liverpool, and then more closely with regard to your partners in London. But what does the Manchester office do day to day at the moment? That you've got a number of specialisms, and you're quite a big office, aren't you?
We're not huge, actually. It's good that you say that we're big, because I think we're probably then showing perceptionally we're probably doing the right thing. So, but like all Knight Frank as a business, we don't chase turnover, we chase profit. And with all due respect to all my colleagues, people cost money. So we keep our teams as trim as we need to be, but more importantly, we pick and choose and we're selective on what we do. What that means is, in our office at the moment, and again, Knight Frank as a business over the years has been renowned mainly on the agency side, both residentially and commercially. But we've changed dramatically over the past 10 years plus, where we've built up a really, really impressive consultancy side to the business. And that's no different in Manchester. So in Manchester, we do all the transactional events you'd expect us to do, from offices to industrial to cattle markets. And then our add-ons on the consultancy side, which is a big part of our business, probably around about 70% of our income and turnover, is valuation, building consultancy, property management, lease advisory, rating. And as I said, we've got some great, great individuals who are market leaders in their fields within the region and Manchester itself.
And it's quite interesting, I think, Knight Frank, as I was growing up in London, early doors, you and Savills were both sort of rooted originally, or had connections with the rural industry, rural surveying and country estates. Do you come across that side of the business at all in Manchester, or are they kept completely separate?
Well, they're separate in the sense they sit underneath our residential banner, but we do work closely together. So yes, we've got mutual clients. And one of our, what we feel, one of our kind of real USPs in offering all our clients, irrespective of the work we're doing for them, is our access to high net worth individuals who typically are either the top of their food chain in their industry or highly successful in their own right and therefore want to invest into property. So, and that residential rural side is a good avenue into that. So we do work together on projects, and we work together with their client base and our client base.
I think that's where, I think you say about the high net worths and so on, I think the level of service they expect as well is something the middle upper sort of sized firms can play to their strength effectively. And I think one of the things I said we were going to talk about today was where you see yourselves going, where are you placed at the moment in the market? You have some huge firms and you don't sit there as a very big global faceless firm, you sit there as a sort of middle upper. Where do you guys see yourself going over the next period of years, and perhaps how is that going to change because of what's going on at the moment?
Well, do you know what, I was trying to rack my brains and probably do a little research to see how many people were in our business when I joined Knight Frank. And the number that came to me was around about 10,000 people across the globe, across our network. Okay. We're now in excess of 19,000 people, which is a lot of people, and it sort of stretches the ability to say we are, we're a family firm. We still approach things as a kind of family-run firm because it's a full equity partnership ownership. But it's hard to do that when you've got 19,000 people. But we've invested heavily into areas across the Americas and especially across Asia, which has probably been our largest investment recently. So that's exposed us as a little office in Manchester into all these different avenues of again, clients or avenues of information and technology that is coming from different parts of our business. So it's really enabled us to improve our offering to our clients on the ground in Manchester. And to really kind of, I suppose, go toe-to-toe with the CBREs and the Jones Lang of this world, who always will be larger than us in terms of numbers. But again, we don't excuse that because our business model is totally different to theirs.
And you've sort of hit the nail on the head there. Does cross-selling really work within a business? So if you've got, I think you've got an office in Hong Kong, a friend of mine works for, and do things come back to London and then eventually Manchester from those international connections?
Hugely, massively. And well, I'll break it back down to two answers to that, Guy. I mean, our office alone, I just mentioned the teams that we have. So we've got roughly eight teams. We're one profit and loss account for that office. Okay. Not individual departments. So if the building surveyors do well, it all goes into the single office pot, to want a bit better phrase. So the cross-selling attitude in the office drives it further because they see everyone gains from it. And actually, as a business per se, we love the entrepreneurial approach. We like people to, and we give people the responsibility and autonomy to go and do what they like to do. And that usually ultimately breeds a cross-selling attitude, because they like to sell the business, like to sell their colleagues to each individual client. And how that stretches overseas, well, you know, the best way to give you is through example. We've just purchased an industrial unit up in Cumbria, without letting any trade secrets out of the way. Mm-hmm. But the purchaser came from the Middle East. The client contact was based in Singapore, but ultimately the money came from the Middle East. And it came through a route via one of our capital market guys in London. So there's three parties of Knight Frank involved. The deal was done. And in terms of how you then effectively share the spoils of the fee to Knight Frank, it was dealt with after the deal was completed. We don't have set rules and regulations. There probably is a rule book somewhere, but no one abides by it, because we deal with it like grown-ups. And in my office, I have the authority, if needed, to, I suppose, arbitrarily agree those things if there's ever a dispute. And in the, where are we now? Wow, 12th year of my nearly 13th year of my running the office, I've probably had to step in once in that time to deal with things. So we just get on with
I think that's where Grosvenor always got on well with Knight Frank, and that's how I got to know you really closely, was through the relationships with the guys who led the business down London, and John Snow, who's retired a couple of years ago, who was the head of the business in the commercial side. Him and I became very good friends, and you know, he supported Glenbrook and its growth and everything else, and that's how we sort of built relationships. And I think you're one of the very strong relationship based firms that exist. So we're very, really pleased to have those connections. Just going on to the purpose of the podcast, really, was to talk about offices, and in particular serviced offices. And it's something we don't dabble with at Glenbrook, but we see a lot of it going on around us. And I thought it'd be good to have a chat about what are serviced offices, where did it all start, the history. I think, you know, look back at London. Where's the market in the UK at the moment? Who dominates the market at the moment in Manchester particularly? What's the recent news stock, and what stock is arriving in terms of serviced offices? Is there too much of it, and what's the demand for it? And then looking at really the impact of what's happening at the moment, and you know, have you got any research or evidence about how the market's going to change? So we'll just have a quick chat through those. I'm conscious we've probably only got about 10 minutes left, but I'm really interested to hear what the market is. So the first question was really, what are serviced offices?
Service offices is really a platform to offer short-term flexible space. So one person, you can effectively rent a one-person desk for a month through to, you know, an area for 100 to 200 workstations or even more, for probably a period of time, as long as you wish and desire to do so. So there are examples of people taking 60, 70,000 square feet of space whilst other buildings are being built for them to move into for a 2 to 3 year period. So it offers total flexibility at a price, of course, and it's a one-off cost that people pay. So it's all encompassing costs rather than the liability of rent, rate, service charge, and also fitting out an office. That's all provided as part of the deal. So you move in, you plug your computers in, and off you go.
And where did it all start? Because it's quite an interesting concept. It's a massive departure away from traditional office leasing. Where and when did it start?
I mean, it's been around for a long time, actually. And it's evolved a lot recently with lots of different operators coming into that market. But traditionally, Regus were the mainstay, and in some areas still are. And they were the key provider of this space globally as well. So they were the brand, they were the kind of Google of the off-service office markets, where you could effectively sign up as a member to Regus and go to any of their facilities across the globe. That's, and plug in and away you go. And that was their I suppose their big sell to their clients. And they didn't really have much competition. I mean, MWB, if you recall, came into the market probably late 90s, early 2000s, subsequently taken on by Regus, by the way, in due course. But and Regus have gone through their own troubles, but obviously Mark Dixon's stood behind them,
And he's a bit of a legend, isn't he? Mark deserves a bit of a mention because he is a bit of a legend in that he's stuck with the business from, presumably it was his business that he originated and founded, I suppose. And then
put a lot of money in himself, don't forget. He's backed it significantly himself. I'm sure he's been rewarded over the years for it, but certainly he's stood on that with them.
And he still runs it now, doesn't he?
Yes, he does, yeah. Mm. Yeah, so Reach was the mainstay player of the market. And then over the last probably 5 to 10 years, we've seen other operators come in. And then over the last 4 or 5 years, it's just exploded. And the word co-working has come this headline across all of the industry. But I think you need to put things in perspective. We all run away with ourselves at times. And let's use Manchester as the context here. If you were to sort of totty up every single service office or co-working centre in Manchester, it's less than 10% of the total office stock. It's about 7.5%.
Really?
So it's big headlines, but small in terms of actual real, I suppose, market movers in that sense. But I will say it's headlines for a reason, because it's caught the imagination of a lot of companies, particularly growth companies, who will use these sorts of facilities to cater for short-term growth when they haven't really either got the ability to house them within an existing building, or they're not quite sure how the business is going. So it has catered for a lot of bigger and smaller companies to get to where they are at the moment.
And Regis were the grandfather of the industry. How have they reinvented themselves, and who are the new upstarts that have come to the market?
Well, Regis had to do something, because WeWork was stealing the show, and WeWork as a brand became this kind of cachet of occupiers wanting to say to their friends and family and colleagues and business acquaintances that, we're in a WeWork, because it had that sort of brand with them. But so what Regis did, they reinvented three or four different lines. So the more famous one of them is called Spaces, which is their kind of branded co-working arm. So they've either refurbished and rebranded different current Regis's into a Spaces unit, or they've taken new facilities, branded Spaces, which is a hybrid between a kind of co-working, very similar feel to a WeWork offering, and some more traditional space, which is the older Regis model. So it's a blend of the two, but branded Spaces. So they've had to reinvent themselves, and they have some other brands underneath the umbrella as well, which caters for different type of occupiers. And then behind that that guy, you've got smaller operators, smaller in the sense of they don't take as much space. So the hungry operators, WeWork and Regis, are taking big quantum buildings, anything from 40 to 100,000 square feet or more. Whereas the next tier down tend to stay in between the kind of 15 to 20,000 square foot range. And there's lots of operators there, from WorkLife to Huckletree to Headspace. Any weird and wonderful name and put the word space next to it pretty much works.
Mm-hmm. And what about local landlords? People have reinvented their landlords, you know, as landlords in Manchester. Have they reinvented and brought out as an alternative to just leasing large chunks of space? Are they trying to diversify by doing their own brand as well?
Not yet. I mean, the obvious ones have, who've always done it well, like Bruntwood. So yeah. Bruntwood's offering, which is now called Made and Managed, is a competitor to that service office co-working environment. And they've always been very successful themselves in offering that. But we haven't seen traditional landlords going to that market yet, but we are expecting it. I mean, the one to mention is Legal & General, who have a company now within their group called Capsule. Now, Capsule offer fully fitted service space. And that ranges from suites of 2 to 3 to 4 to 5,000 square feet. Again, fully fitted, similar arrangement to a co-worker. Yeah. And I would have thought, subject to the business interruption we're going through at the moment, we were expecting other funds and other main UK landlords to delve into that market themselves.
And I understand, or I see a lot of space being taken up over the last few years by serviced offices co-working space. What has come online recently and what is coming online in the future? Give us some headlines of some you know, the great and the good.
So the last, certainly over what last 2 years, WeWork were the highlights. So they now have, what, 5 centres in Manchester, all in excess of 40,000 square feet, wow, with the largest being around about 70,000 square feet. Spaces have come up the rails quickly, in they've refurbished their existing facility at Peterhouse, yeah, which is in excess of 100,000 square feet, and we let 125 Deansgate, the Worthington and RevCap scheme, 2 spaces in its entirety. So that's 123,000 square feet.
Wow.
But during that process, typical Regus stroke Spaces, they took an opportunity to effectively agree a 60,000 square foot deal of half of effectively 125 Deansgate to BT, while BT have their new building built for them down at New Bailey. So that's understand that's a 2 or 3 year deal for them. So half that space is effectively taken up already before completion. It's a market that's seen some big deals in the service sector, definitely.
Is there too much of it? Is there going to be demand for all this new space? I mean, there's some stonking big deals there you just spoken about.
I'm not worried about this market because I think there is a demand. And when you delve into it a bit further, you see why. Because we're not the stereotypical service office co-worker company. People have a mindset that it's probably a company of 1 or 2 or maybe half a dozen people. Mm. And they're shoehorned into a small room in a corner with probably no natural light, paying not as much as they need to. Whereas that's not quite the case in Manchester. And what we are finding is some big organisations that have a number of people in those facilities. So for example, Lloyds Bank have 170 workstations in the modern St. Peter's Square of WeWork. Our clients, Bet365, use them on a regular basis and probably have a rolling facility with them to have 100 seats anywhere at any one time.
Really?
So there are some big operators, and operators have used them in a very sensible way. So Money Supermarket, when they were deciding to move into Manchester, before opting and then committing to where they are now, which is the top few floors of number 1 Spinning Fields, they took, I think it was around about 60 desks at WeWork, again in St. Peter's Square, to move people into the city, to get used to the city, to use it as a test bed. So there are a lot of big organisations that are filling the service office operators to cater for growth while they either move or whether they relocate, or is it just purely project based, which they don't need to be within the kind of mothership, and they can be elsewhere whilst a 2 or 3 year contract is run through.
I see. So there's a bit of resilience there in that sense, because one of the things, sort of moving on to where we are today, what do you think the impact of the current crisis is going to have? Because one of my concerns is that a lot of these leases, whereas our lease in our office building, which is actually quite small, it's for 5 years or 10 years or with a 5 year break, a lot of these are 10 to 12 month terms or agreements. How is that going to be impacted by, you know, the natural void rate of people and their businesses going through the current crisis?
I'm not sure it's going to have too much difference. And I think it goes down to pure demand and supply. We're still in a market that is heavily undersupplied with a lot of pent up demand. I can't see us coming out of hopefully where we are at the moment and then there being a zero demand for office space. I think we may operate within a building differently. What the last few weeks has taught us is that it's pretty much what we always knew, but probably didn't delve into deep enough, is that we can work remotely. We have the technology to do it. We're not losing sort of business through this scenario we are in. We're just doing it differently. And when we get back into our offices, I think we will probably continue working more remotely than we've done previously, but we'll always have a base. I think that social interaction that people are missing at the moment and craving for will always be wanted and certainly desired. As I said, we might just do things slightly differently. I don't think it's going to have an effect on on the demand for organizations like yours, Guy, wanting to be based in the city center and wanting to have face-to-face meetings. I don't think you're going to cut your space down by half and have half your staff working away. I think you're going to want to have a base and a foothold in. And I think that is going to be replicated across the board. And I think what will continue is the desire from companies to have what they call the kind of core and flex model, where, and it differs in different organizations, they probably prompt for a kind of a core element of their business being based in an office, say 75% of them in an office on a longer term, then either have a short-term top-up on a more flexible lease, either within the same building or a neighboring building or even a co-working entity. So they we think that will continue, which caters for high growth businesses and gives people flexibility and comfort as an organization that you can either increase your turnover, your turnover of staff in terms of recruitment quickly, or alternatively, you can downsize quickly if the need arises. So what this current situation has taught us is there is a ever increasing desire for us to have a workplace, and a workplace where we all get on and we can all socialize together, because what we do well is we communicate and we build those relationships. We as an industry, you're slightly different. We don't build anything. We don't make anything. We advise. And therefore, our sweet spot is our sharing of knowledge and information with our colleagues, and then how we then advise our clients thereafter. And as much as it's worked well remotely for the moment, and I do think it'd be slightly different when we go back, there will be an absolute desire to get back into a similar routine.
I agree with all you say there in the long term, but I was doing a bit of research for this and read a report, it was a global report on serviced offices, and it said that the average natural void rate per month is 5 to 8%. And they reckon that whilst across the whole of their research, serviced offices were about 95% occupied in February this year, by the end of May, that's going to be down to 70 or 80%. And by July, if we're still in the same situation we're in today, down to 50%. So I don't disagree that long term, that it's a resilient model, and it's probably akin to, you know, to a certain extent like the PRS, where you have lots of different leases falling in lots of different times. So you're actually protected by having that variety within your building. My one concern is over the next 6 months, what is it going to look like if we're on lockdown for a longer period? Are people going to start ending their contracts to try and reduce their overhead, which is only natural because cash is king?
I think they will, Guy. I think that will happen if this is still ongoing in July. I think it's probably even happened now, where people have tried to cancel, if not successfully cancel, their contracts, similar to companies asking for, you know, rental holidays. If you have the ability to cancel the contract and whilst you're working from home, why wouldn't you if you're a smaller company? The larger companies have a bit more resilience, I would say. But what I'm also expecting, though, when we are released, there will be desire for those individuals to get back into that working habit. I think more will want to go back into an office environment that don't want to go into an office environment for different reasons. And I think that is what we hope to see, and that's what we are reading we'll see. But I do think people will do things differently. And I've read lots of different articles, all of which are fascinating, about how perhaps offices will be designed differently. Like, you know, with certainly a lot more voice recognition, certainly in hands-off technology. So we could, you know, open doors without pushing them, that we can look at more automated routes to kind of passing through real estate that, you know, stops us all having push points that we can share with others, and having more rigorous cleaning regimes and lots of different things. So, I think that will be something which be instilled into offices, as much as different practices of how people sit together. Perhaps they won't face each other. Perhaps they'll face apart. Or
one thing I've been on the phone this morning. We're sorting out is our tech. You know, we like to think we've got good technology. We use technology, but actually, one thing we're going to try very hard over the next few weeks to try and change is standards and the quality of our technology. And I think, you know, having this pause actually allows people to think about, as you say, layouts or technology or connectivity. Whereas I thought we were doing it quite well, I think, you know, just by experiencing what we've been going through now and doing this over Zoom, we've got to up our game. So it certainly gives you a chance to reflect on things, doesn't it?
It does. I think one thing which we'll all do differently is business travel. I mean, I can't see us arranging to go to London for a couple of meetings when we can do them on Zoom or Microsoft Teams or something different as efficiently and far more efficiently, less costs, less input into the environment. And it's just a better business practice, in my view. Mm. That's what I've learned, certainly over the past few weeks.
Yeah, very good. Well, I think I've exhausted serviced offices. We're probably sending everybody to sleep out there at the moment. But it was something that I think has changed massively. And I especially seeing 125 Deansgate, we took the team around there recently, and it was really great to see it. And spaces are doing a good job. So I think it's really interesting to see that. And hopefully when we get back after the lockdown, spaces will be in occupation and it'll be open and we can all go and see and touch and feel it. Yep. Any other pearls of wisdom to add before we wrap up?
No, I've just been hugely impressive how everybody has adapted so quickly to the scenario we're in and has got very comfortable in looking at yourself across the screen and everybody else and all the new ones. I tell you, it's been a lovely thing, actually. It's been a real leveler for everybody. And it's been really nice to see, you know, people's home life actually come into their kind of work life with kids in the background and dogs sat on the... It's just been a real nice way of probably taking the edge of what is quite a stressful situation.
What I'm going to look forward to, David, is seeing you back out in your shorts and T-shirt with me, because that's how, well, one of our best experiences, I'd say, in the last 5 years is that you and I, along with 30 or 40 other people, raised a massive amount of money with Steve Byrne before he passed away for his charity and the Ronald McDonald Foundation. And we went and did the Yorkshire Three Peaks, but it didn't quite go to plan for you and I, did it?
No, being who we are, we thought we'd do it again, didn't we? We thought we'd go and stretch it over 2 days. Seems a bit, seemed the wrong thing to do, to waste all the fun for one day. So we did it over two.
Well, we lost Lloydie at the first stile. One of our colleagues, Chris Lloyd, didn't even make it to the first stile. And then you and I stormed up the first peak. We stormed up the second peak. And by the third peak, we decided that it was probably time for the pub, wasn't it, really? And we retired back to the pub. And then we went back a few months later and went and conquered the final peak. So the photo that's attached to this podcast is David and I at the top of the final peak of the three peaks challenge in Yorkshire. So that's the photo.
And we should stress, Guy, we did more miles quantum than anybody else, because we went way around the final peak, which is Ingleborough. So I'm lasting on that one. It was a great day, a phenomenal cause, and a brilliant thing that you guys did in organizing that. So well done, Nathan.
Well, lovely way to finish. And you better get back and get your stew ready for dinner with the kids. And I just thank you for joining us on another Glenbrook podcast. We're going to start focusing on some of the specialisms going forward. And one of the things we're going to do next is look at whether beds or sheds is the thing to invest in. So tune in for that one next time. And thank you, David, for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.